Did I tell you I started going to the gym?
No, you mentioned, you kind of alluded to that, but no, you haven't mentioned it since.
I wish I could tell you exactly what it was that was the, you know, the tipping point of like, I wish there was like some moment that I could identify where I just like summoned, I went to some previously unknown well of like ego control. And I was just like, this is a responsible, healthy thing that adults do. And I found the closest gym to my house and, you know, emailed them. I do not know what the precipitating event was, but I did it. And I'm maybe about 3 weeks in, 3 or 4 weeks in to doing personal training. I have a personal trainer. His name is Todd. And I go Monday, Wednesday, Friday for an hour a week.
Wow.
And let me tell you, you know all those people who say, all these people who are like runners.
I was going to say, are you going to tell me that you feel so great?
Well, that is the thing, right? Is like people start working out and they're like, oh, I feel amazing. And I'm like clear-headed and I have all this energy and I just feel great all the time. And you're like sore the next day and you wake up and you're like, yeah, I like earned that. I did something. Like, I want to tell you, having done this myself, that is a total fucking lie. I feel awful. Here's the thing. Leading up to going to the gym, I'm dreading it because I know that I'm going to have to perform exercise. Todd is going to make me exercise. My personal trainer, Todd. At the gym, pure misery. Every moment of it. It's boring. It's excruciating. It's difficult, but it's not challenging in the sense that I really feel like I have almost any control over it. Right. And then afterwards, I am sore and tired and cranky. And the next day, though, that's where it really sucks because you're just yesterday was gym day and today is, let's just say it's 2:22 PM. I'm an hour and 20 minutes late to this podcast. And I was just like sitting around in my underwear, answering emails all morning. Like I didn't want to do anything.
So you're really selling this, Max. You're really, but you know, I'm honestly like, I'm super jealous because, you know, it's something that is like really high on my list of things that I need to do. Like perhaps the highest on my list of things to do, you know, and, you know, I've been meaning for a while to actually like bring the exercise bike in from the garage or actually and go and buy like a set of free weights. Cause it's not like I lift, but I used to exercise with weights and I know that if they're in here and if I have access to them, like I'll listen to an audiobook and I'll do that cause I used to, but I haven't even done that. Like I could do that with a phone call, you know, which is kind of ironic given that like moving the exercise bike inside would itself be exercise. So I should do it myself, but I know I won't. I mean, the last 6 months of me wanting to do it and not doing it is proof enough of that.
I think for me, like the only previous, let's just say like voluntary organized, physical exertion that I've ever participated in was I did boxing lessons for about a year and a half a few years ago. And I actually kind of really got into the game of that. Like I really liked sparring. I liked the math of like trying to think three steps ahead. And I found it very motivational that one of the main goals is to not get punched in the face. That really, that helped me, you know, I was surprised, but it turns out I was very adverse to being punched in the face and I was willing to do a lot of work to avoid that outcome. But I don't know, for myself, having the trainer is, I know it's kind of the obnoxious, you know, ultra privileged, lazy way to exercise. But I honestly do not know. It's just an area of like, I know how deep the well goes of information that is available to you about how to exercise and how to maintain your health and all of that. So I know how much there is to learn about that, and I don't know any of it. And I'm led to believe that it's extremely difficult and there's conflicting opinions, and it's like buying a digital camera. Like, I just don't want to wade into it. Like, I'm just going to go to a photographer and be like, please just tell me what one camera to get.
Right.
And, you know, which is the Sony RX1 for any of our listeners. Love that thing. But however, anyway, I find the personal trainer very motivating because it's like, if I don't show up, he's going to be mad and I'm still paying for the session. You know, he sort of sets a routine and sets the pace and makes sure that I do everything correctly so I don't injure myself. Like, I haven't injured myself so far. I just feel sore and miserable all the time.
Yeah. You know, and I know, I mean, I view that as like a good use of, like, you know, psychological levers, because the best shape I've ever been in, and it's probably hard for anyone to believe who's seen a picture of me in these last 10 years, but like, I used to be in really good shape. Like, back when I was a freshman, I was doing two different martial arts, and, you know, I was nearly 100 pounds lighter. If you can even, that's a grotesque number to like look at that and say, wow, that is how much heavier I am now. But it was, I loved doing the martial art. Now that's not entirely true. I did enjoy it, but like while I was doing it, cause like the martial arts session was 2 hours long. And, you know, and it was sweaty and it was hard and you were there and then you're like, God, I'm so tired. And you still had an hour and 15 minutes to go. And like, just the stretch was like 30 minutes long. And then you'd start doing some exercises. Then you did forms. And then at the end of it all, you spar. And I'm like, no, I don't want to spar now. I'm so fucking tired.
Did you have an instructor who would like, lazily deflect your punches like as hard as you tried? He would just like effortlessly like sidestep you and find your little weaknesses and poke you.
You know,
I had that. It was pretty hilarious especially once you're tired, how much someone can just like mess with you like a cat.
Well, what was interesting is that particular martial art, which was Budokai Karate, the instructor was also one of the psychology professors. And he was not a big guy. I mean, I love this professor. He was a great prof, you know, really good at what he did. I took a bunch of his classes, and he was a great martial arts instructor as well. Now, not a big man at all. You know, I probably had like 4 or 5 inches on him. And even then when I was in shape, I probably had, you know, maybe 10, 15, 20 pounds on him. And, but at one point, like, we did different kinds of sparring. And the nice thing about that martial art is like everyone sparred, but everyone sparred against someone who was really, really good. It was no like, hey, white belts, match off and flail at each other, you know, because that's a great way for people to get seriously hurt. It was like you fought the black belts and you fought the brown belts, which meant they were really in control of everything. And so it was pretty safe. But rather than just kind of sparring one time, we did almost a type of wrestling where, and it wasn't a type of wrestling, it was, well, you know, it was wrestling. And the point of it was to plant your feet, and you started with your hands on your opponent's shoulders, and you faced each other standing up, and the purpose was to get them to move their feet. And you could do anything, you know, just like pushing and shoving and whatever. And so, and that was when I first realized, because I don't think about it a lot, but I matched off against my professor. And when I put my hands on him, I'm like, oh my God, you know, sensei is tiny, you know, compared to me. And I'm like, I can do this. I can shove him around. I've got a huge advantage when we're this close and we already have our hands on each other. And so I got in there and I put like I made a quick grab and I got one of my arms underneath his knee. And then I got my other arm underneath, like locked it with my other hand behind his knee. And I'm like, I'm going to be able to throw him onto his back here. This will be awesome. And then suddenly my feet lifted up off the ground and he held me upside down with his hands around my waist and just kind of shook me a little bit once. And they put me back down and he's like, I kind of could have put you wherever I wanted. And I'm like, "Oos, sensei." Like, yes, sir. So, you know, that was great. I did it for a couple of years. And because I knew that people would know if I was missing, I would go, you know, because it would kind of be embarrassing not to show up. And I liked these people. You know, and I did a bunch of different martial arts and I did fencing. Then I coached fencing. And there, I mean, you have to show up because if you don't show up, there's no class without you. But then I let that go because I got so busy writing. And ever since then, it's been an increasingly rapening spiral into fat bastarddom.
So for you, the most immediate thing would be like take the exercise bike out of the garage and set some sort of schedule with it?
You know, it's availability. It's like, I think of it as kind of the psychological reverse of having a bag of chips in the house. You know, because if there's a bag of chips in the house, eventually I'll get hungry and I'll eat it. But if there's was this exercise bike available here or these free weights, you know, I would be like, oh, you know, I should get some exercise. And then I'd look at it and say, there it is. There is where I do the exercise. And then I would do it. As opposed now, I go, yeah, I should get some exercise. And then I like think about the garage and trying to manhandle this exercise bike up a, you know, four stairs to get it inside. And I'm like, maybe I'll see what's on Twitter instead, you know?
See, this is what's so interesting about, I totally agree with your way of thinking about that. And I think people often get up in their heads about why they do or don't do things. And to me, the simplest answer is like, if the exercise thing is right in front of you, you use it. There's this great tip that I heard. I wish I could remember where I heard this. It sounds like something that I would have heard from my friend Merlin Mann on his Back to Work podcast. But he's like, there's a million software solutions to solve the problem of I need to bring this thing to work tomorrow with me. You could put it in OmniFocus. You could make a reminder. You could tell Siri to remind you. There's 50 different ecosystems to do that. But the simplest thing is to put it in front of the front door, because then when you go to leave, it's right there and you can't miss it. And that is just such a good, I mean, it's like a little metaphor, but it's such a good way of thinking about the world, of like the environment that you live in and the life that you design for yourself should be, you should design the path of least resistance to have the outcome that you want, because otherwise you're just, there's all this friction in the process that's going to prevent you from the outcome that you want of going, of exercising, or, you know, if you have chips in the house, you're going to eat them or whatever. So I think I totally agree with you on that point. And where this whole thing falls apart to me is like, this is why I'm so neurotic about being tidy and about having the fewest number of things and trying to pick the really good things and having them at hand and having like a clean, simple room. So the only things I can see are the things I'm, you know, using for the purpose that the room is for. Like, all that stuff is important to me, because it's like, if I'm going to go in the kitchen and cook, I want to see the simple things that I need to cook. I don't want a lot of mediocre things. I don't want my second choice spatula. I just want the best thing, and I want it at hand available, because anything else is like friction that prevents me from actually starting to cook. You know, if I summon the willpower to sit down and do some work, like, I don't want to have to dig around to find my good pen. I just don't want any other pens. I just want the good pen that I like, and I want it to be at hand so that it no longer becomes an excuse for me to not do the work. It's just me and the pen. And I just feel like we that's an area where we just don't see eye to eye. Like, I think we've talked about this previously in the podcast of like, it just doesn't affect you.
Well, no, actually, I think, first off, I think that's a human characteristic. I do think that you have more of it than most folks. And I think you have a little more of it than me. But it is specifically in terms of environment. I know we have different tolerances, you know, and I usually would think of it, you know, like the great example is like when you cohabitate with somebody, you know, who ends up doing the dishes, mm-hmm. you know, unless you have a rota or something, the person that does the dishes.
Unless you have a what?
Like a rota where like everyone signed up for a different schedule.
It's a rota.
Is that a term? I want to look that up on the internet now. I'm pretty sure.
I feel like that's a quaint Wisconsin term that people say.
R-O-T-A. I've never spelled it, I don't think. Rota. Other use. Oh, yep. Rota is a schedule. List of employees, work times, responsibilities for a given period of time. Yeah. So that is actually a word.
Uh-oh, I got the cat on my lap now, so we got to keep doing this podcast indefinitely until she leaves.
and then they died.
Yeah. So anyway, when are we redoing your home office?
Yeah.
Listener question for this week. Let me give people. We probably got to explain that to people. So So a couple months ago, Veronica and I did a little road trip, and we came up to Stevens Point to visit Pat, and got a tour of your kind of amazing array of like the house, the workhouse, the Masonic Temple that's the World Builders headquarters. I get to see the whole operation, but there was one room there were a couple rooms I wasn't allowed to go in. There was the writer's room in the workhouse that no one is allowed to go in because that's the special room where the books get written. But there was also the home office, which was forbidden because of how much it would upset, how much you knew that it would upset me to see the condition of your home office. So we had a stretch goal that we proposed for World Builders for the last World Builders, where if you guys raised like $1.2 million, I would come to your home office in Stevens Point with like a construction dumpster, and it would be a total reckoning of me gutting your home office and turning it into I'm going to go in there with like rubber gloves, full, just, it's going to be the purge. And new furniture, new bookcases, everything's going to be organized, new office supplies, it's going to be awesome.
Yeah, I remember we chatted about it, and you're like, yeah, let's make it a stretch goal. And I'm like, okay, sure. And I named the number, and you're like, oh, come on.
Yeah, I was like, that's a cop-out because you're never going to raise $1.2 million. Because I believe up until this year, World Builders had never raised $1 million in a single fundraising session. So I was like, that's impossible.
We hit it, and we will do it. It's mostly like a scheduling issue. I've been traveling so much. But yeah, we absolutely will do that.
Oh, well, you don't need to be there. I'll just show up. Oh, and when you come back, all your
more terrifying.
Yeah. What do you need to be there for?
To weep bitter tears of frustration. And
that's what the people paid for.
Exactly. It's the people have paid for my tears and anguish. And I don't want to deprive them of that.
All right, we got to get a date going on the calendar here. I'm very excited. I'm going to show up with my whole construction crew. It's going to be awesome.
the delight I hear in your voice, it makes this so much worse.
You know, we're going to have big contractor bags that we're carrying out full of all the stuff in there.
Oh. Okay. Can we throw in a caveat here?
Okay.
Where like Amanda has the ability to like go through the dumpster, not to retrieve things for me, but to retrieve things that they will then like make use of for World Builders.
Yeah. I mean, listen, whatever. I mean, any employees that you want to order into the trash, I'm totally fine with. No, I mean, we're not going to throw away anything that would be like, it's auctionable. It's like all the garbage gets thrown out. Anything auctionable or interesting goes to the temple, you know, gets put in boxes and sent to the temple. And then we, where would we even start? First of all, we got to repaint. I think you need a big chalkboard wall with like a railing for chalk and like erasers so you can like draw stuff out. I think you need a big bookshelf for all of your books and stuff, and then like a very nice ergonomic computer chair and desk.
Okay. That reassures me a little bit. I kind of picture you coming in with a flamethrower.
Possibly. How about this? Possibly a little mini refrigerator.
Oh.
You get you some spark. We'll get you. What do you have in there? All sparkling water, some mead.
See, now you're just trying to lull me into a sense of false security. I now I feel even more scared. Now that this gentle Max terrifies me more than the ruthless Max I was expecting.
I'm very excited about this. I love cleaning and organizing stuff. This is I'm having the same conversation with Veronica because we got a house. And we've been doing, you know, it's a whole huge construction project that's been ongoing for like, I don't know, a long time.
Forever.
It's been a long time. And we're getting ready to move. I think we're moving in July. The house will be done. And, you know, it's like I moved from having, you know, I went from college to moving from apartment to apartment for years. And I accumulated all this stuff of like, you know, it's like none of it was like a designed process. It's just like, oh, here's this piece of hand-me-down furniture and here's this yard sale thing. And it's just like I accumulated this like loose collection of stuff that was never like I never picked it to be functional or fit together. It was always like trying to solve this problem or solve that problem in this apartment or that apartment. Now I have this like crazy amalgamation of stuff. And, you know, Veronica was in grad school for years and she has all of her sort of grad school and apartment stuff. And like we both have a lot of like shitty kitchenware and like, you know, old bad like pots and pans, and we've like gradually started replacing this in the apartment that we share together. But like I am in favor, to me it's like the new house is like it's a little bit like pressing the reset button. It's like this is the time. It's like, you know, it's emotionally easier now to say let's get rid of all of these old pots and pans, the bad cookware that we had in like college dorm rooms, and replace them on a you know one in one out basis with like really nice stainless steel stuff that we'll have for the rest of our lives, and it'll look great hanging in the house, and like it's all part of like designing the right environment for this one space that we have. But I think for Veronica a lot of that stuff is tied to the memory of it, where it's like, oh well, if I get rid of this pan, that's like getting rid of all the memories of the meals that I cooked in the pans and the times that we had dinner together and enjoyed the food that came from that pan.
Yeah, and I was just gonna say, like, are you really gonna get rid of your favorite spoon?
Oh, I can't say that I won't say that I don't understand the nostalgia thing, because I have some things in my life that I feel that way about, or I'm throwing something out and I have that pang of like, ooh, am I going to regret this in 10 years? Am I going to look back and say, I wish I saved this little, you know, tchotchke or whatever because of the memory of it or whatever. But in general, I try to cultivate a sense of being unsentimental about things. I just think things will never make me happy. Not that I don't try, but they won't do it. And I don't know, like I would rather have this sort of feeling of, how do I put it? A feeling of liquidity with my things, of like the things I have, if they all get destroyed in a fire, like I don't really care that much. It's because I could get new ones off of the internet. You know, it's like I try not to even think of it as my things. I try to just think of it as like the thing I'm using at the moment, and later there'll be another thing that I use. But a well-lived life and a life that you look back on fondly, or however you want to say it, it's not having the right pots and pans. It's kind of, to me, it's all about, do the pots and pans get you through the cooking painlessly so that you can enjoy the experience of it and spend time with people? And, you know, did the things you have, it's not like they fill up with memory energy and then you have that and it's like in a jar. It's like, do the things you have get out of the way, and do they let you put all of your attention on people and relationships?
Yeah. And that's eminently healthy, I think. But, you know, I think, you know, if you looked at both of our ideal environments, I think that mine would look maybe more like that stereotypical alchemist's like wizard's tower, where there's like shelves full of bizarre things.
Mm-hmm. You would live in like a 1930s like apothecary, and I would and I would live in an Apple store.
Well, I was actually thinking more along the lines of like a not Spartan, although that's the right word for it, but something a little more like a Japanese Zen master, you know, like very clean, very, you know, very like a lot of empty surfaces. And it's interesting. I was just visiting a friend in LA and I came into his house. And the first thing I thought was like, wow, I thought, and I didn't think, wow, this place is so clean. What I thought was this place is so empty, because there was like a bunch of empty floor space and like kind of a mantelpiece with like three things on it. And like the walls had a few pieces of art, but not a lot. And then I went into the other room and there was like a huge counter island with nothing on it. And it is, so it was like, if there was a word for clean, but also disturbingly empty, that would have been the word that I'd used. And, you know, so we're hanging around and eventually he says, oh, he goes, oh, by the way, he goes, that thing that's sitting out there, he goes, you know, where I was, you know, roasting some coffee and that thing, he goes, you know, my wife is gone. He goes, that wasn't out, you know? And I'm like, oh my God, he thinks that this place is cluttered, you know, like, and I didn't have the words to express to him like that. It looks like he's been robbed to me, you know, it, huh. Or maybe he just moved in and like the movers haven't brought the rest of his stuff, because if I have a counter or a table or a shelf, it will fill with stuff like books and everything. I mean, you've seen my living space, and since you've been here, it's spiraled into further madness. Like looking around, you know, there is not a square foot of shelf space and there's not 3 square feet of floor space that just doesn't have something sitting on it. And I think for me, I think I would like it to be better organized. If it was better organized and if it was more attractively arranged, I do know that I would benefit mentally from that. But I think if it was utterly clear, and like if everything was gone, I feel like I don't know if I would thrive in that environment. But I don't know, because I've never lived there. I have heard like the psychological theory where they say that clutter is actually, you know, like if you're trying to multitask in your head,
mm-hmm.
people say there really is no such thing as genuine multitasking. What you're really doing is task shifting.
I have heard that. I've also heard there's this idea. Do you know about ego depletion theory? It's a little bit related to spoon theory that we previously discussed.
Yeah.
So ego depletion theory is this psychological idea that humans have a sort of a finite amount of ego, which is like your ability to like control yourself and make good decisions. And it's like if you exercise in the morning and eat healthy in the afternoon, you're more likely to make like stupid gambling decisions because you've used up some of your like decision making ability. And this is like a very active area of like social psychology that's been studied pretty extensively in the last few years. I've read a ton of studies about it, of like if you make people solve math problems and then you ask and then you put them in a room with cookies, they'll eat more cookies than people who didn't solve math problems first.
Yeah, there has been interesting stuff coming up about this theory.
But I believe there's also right now a huge repeatability crisis across all social science, but it's particularly hitting psychology. And, you know, psychology is, my understanding is that there's, you know, it's a there's extreme pressure on psychological researchers to come up with like surprising counterintuitive results to get funding for the research. And there's a good amount of like cherry picking at the worst and at the best, the kind of academically accepted practice of p-hacking, which is basically just like designing your experiment to get the very, to get the statistical certainty you need to publish. And
Hold on. I need to hear that term. P-hacking?
Yeah, I'm not the right person to explain this, but the idea is that you have a P in an experiment. You know, there's a quantitative element even to like social science research, which is sort of, to me, where it starts to drift into a little bit of bullshit, because putting a number on something squishy doesn't make it less squishy. It's just a number that you put on it. But anyhow, your certainty is value in that equation called P, and what you can do is P-hacking.
Like yeah, the statistical analysis.
Right.
So you
design the experiment to get you the p value you need, the certainty value you need to publish. I hope I'm not explaining that like a jackass, but I think that's about right. And as I understand it, I think it's sort of dicey, but it's also just like everybody does it. Because why would you design an experiment that you think would fail? I mean, it's just sort of like basic incentives, right? Like, there's no incentive to design costly, difficult experiments that you think are going to fail.
Well, there are incentives. It's called science and human knowledge. You know, that's why that's not entirely true.
Yeah, how's that going for the state of Wisconsin university system? I mean, it's like the funding is, I mean, it's brutal, but right? Like, they're revoking tenure and funding is on the chopping block. Like, you know, people need to justify their work.
That's not because of science. That's because we have like a festering boil on our ass.
Well, it's a problem across academia, right? Which is there's not enough funding for everyone to have all the money to do the things they want to do. And so if you're in a department with 10 psychology groups, your group needs to be doing research that's fundable. You need to be competitive. And like, in order to get that funding and get grants and get grad students and get all that stuff, like, you better find something surprising. You better find that the people who do the math problems eat more cookies.
No. I'm actually going to argue that foundational assumption you just had there, where you're saying like, there's not enough funding. Now there's not enough funding because people have been pulling money away from the funding. You know, like at the same time that Scott Walker pulled all this money from the university system, he gave the exact same amount of money to build a fucking sports stadium for a bunch of people that already have a bunch of fucking money.
Well, this is a whole separate issue where we should clearly eliminate college athletics except for intramurals and divert all of the and whatever revenue is lost by that will just be made up with that's fine, because then you'll have more money in the budget for academic stuff, and probably a lot less people will go to big state schools, and that's fine too. Those people shouldn't be in school. If you go to school to watch football, don't go to college. Anyway, how about that bomb?
Yeah, I like that. That should be the title for this week.
Yeah, no, I highly recommend there's a small but growing publicly acceptable argument that's being made for banning all competitive college athletics, and I definitely recommend the Intelligence Squared U.S. debate about should we ban college football. Very good debate, well argued on both sides, and my side annihilated the opposition. not to say no one should play football, just why the fuck would it be at a college? Like, it doesn't make any sense. Why would you, the institution that's designed to grow your brain and make you smarter, have you do activities that cause brain damage? It makes no sense.
And that I agree with. Now, hold on. I'm going to come out of left field at you, and I'm going to say there's absolutely a place for sport in college.
So in Europe, they have like intramurals. So meaning people in the school play sports together in a friendly collegiate way. And I believe there are way more people in Europe, in European schools, who participate in sports because of intramurals than in American schools.
Exactly. Like in the same way that like recess is really healthy for kids in younger grades. Like when we lose recess, I mean, there's a ton of research that suggests that like if our bodies are active during the day, like we're happier, we're healthier, we do better work, we can concentrate more. So, you know, having some of that in college, I think, is great as well. Now, the way it's treated and handled and funded is a huge load of
it's obscene. If the football coach is the most highly paid person in the school, not that I don't, I'm not ignorant. I understand why. It's because in many schools where that's the case, the football coach contributes more value to the organization than anyone else. But that I understand why, but that's wrong. That's not what a college is for. It's not, I'm not trying to say that there, you know, it's like, I'm not trying to make a naive argument of like, oh, it's unjust or whatever. It's perfectly just given the current incentive structure, which is why you should ban college sports.
Yeah. It's, you know, that's, you know, it's a great example of why, you know, things left to follow their own natural course do not, you know, just because something works itself out and evolves naturally does not mean that it is for the best.
Right. You know? I hate this strain in contemporary politics. I've said before that if there was one idea I could have everybody in America sort of, I could wave my wand and have them understand this concept and no other thing. You get to pick one thing. I would say it's the distinction between can and should. Because I understand that people that you can do all of these things in a free market, but that doesn't mean that you should do it. And the whole premise of government, like, why have government, right? Why not just have corporations compete absent all regulation in a perfectly free market and let the market sort everything out, right? If people want paved roads, they'll pay a vendor to come and pave the road in front of their house. Well, the reason that does not work is that not every incentive is solved by a free market. In fact, there are lots of perverse incentives, which in economics are called externalities, meaning there are costs that are obscured that you don't pay the whole cost of. So the classic example of an externality is driving an SUV. You do not pay the full cost of driving an SUV. You have to buy the car, but you do not pay the full cost to society of burning all of that gas and putting all of those emissions into the air. That's why you have a government. A government in a classical economic, I'm talking about like fucking Adam Smith free market economics. The role of government is to regulate. The government steps in and corrects the externality. So if people are not paying the full cost of their automobile in the sticker price, the government steps in and taxes it so that they use that money to do other environmental remediation to clean things up. That's why we have the government. Like, you're telling, like, and so this whole backwards argument of like, oh, well, if the market values the football coach more highly than the academic provost, then the football coach is contributing the most value and he should be paid the most. That is totally wrong. That's a classic case for regulation because it makes no rational sense.
Yeah. The another good one that, you know, touches really, I think on a lot of people is plastic bags, you know, like plastic bags, you know, like shopping bags are super cheap for a supermarket to purchase and give away because, you know, that's a cost for them. However, the real like environmental cost, you know, when you look at like the fact that these things, you know, or any of these plastic packaging things, the real environmental cost is borne, you know, by everyone. The fact that there's, you know, the huge trash mass in the ocean, the fact that, you know, animals are eating this stuff and dying.
It's also a case of something that's plastic bags in particular are particularly sticky and difficult to regulate. So to give what's happening in Chicago right now, the city council passed a ban on plastic bags. And of course, you can't just, what is a plastic bag, right? You can't just say we're banning plastic bags because what does that mean, right? Like, can I have a backpack that's made out of recycled plastic? Is that a plastic bag?
Right.
So it's like you have to define it. So they define plastic bags as, I don't know, they put some very narrow definition on it. So it's like the canonical free plastic bag you get at the grocery store, right? What happened is every store in Chicago now, like Walgreens and CVS and all of the stores that you go to buy things, they still give you plastic bags, but they manufacture them to this ridiculous thickness. So it's now they're like giving you six plastic bags because they've figured out how to manufacture these things so that they use substantially more plastic and they don't meet the qualification as to be considered a plastic a disposable plastic bag.
And see, I would actually use that as an example of the need for regulation. That's not an example of the failure of regulation. It just, it goes to show how far people will go to make bad decisions when left unattended.
It's an example of bad. I mean, it's really an example of just, it's just bad regulation. I mean, it is an example of legislation gone awry because it's legislation with good incentives, but it was extremely stupid. Everybody knew it was stupid when it was being debated because of how easy the workaround would be. And they did it anyway. And so it's an example of creating legislation, creating perverse incentives. But to me, it's like, so just to take a step back of like, well, how does this fit into the whole regulation versus not regulation, you know, discussion? To me, it's like, I feel like, well, we've been sold this whole bill of goods of like regulation should be happening in the consumer level so that the damage to the environment occurs when you're in the grocery store and you choose not to use a reusable grocery bag. When in reality, or it occurs when you buy a Nalgene bottle, or environmentalism occurs when you purchase an eco-friendly car. But the reality of it is, I'm pretty sure if everybody stopped driving cars in the entire United States and everybody stopped using plastic grocery bags and everybody stopped using drinking water bottles, it would have a very negligible effect on carbon output and environmental issues because the true environmental sort of intervention occurs at the industrial level.
Yeah, and I would want to say let me see that math.
I think, maybe some of our listeners can find this stuff, but I think I'll see what I can dig up on the subject. But I'm pretty sure like this whole idea of environmentalism as a fashion statement that individual consumers can make, it's a pretty shitty bill of goods. It's this whole idea of like, oh, well, if you go to Starbucks and you pay 5 cents extra, it's like they'll give it to the poor farmers who grow the beans in an unfair economic system. Like, it's all it is. It's not really deeply addressing the root of the issue. All it is it's letting you engage in destructive consumerist behavior and absolving you of your guilt for your consumerism in the same purchase. Like,
you're right.
Like, you can't buy yourself out of consumerism. It's the wrong philosophy.
And that's why where it really becomes complicated, where you take one step in the right direction in one area. You know, and I can see, you know, this whole discussion just kind of touches back on this general, like, how do we untie this immense Gordian knot of social fuck-upedness? Like, you know, everything seems to, depending on my mood, right? Everything seems to be shit, and everything touches on everything else, and like, how do we begin to unravel all of the bullshittery?
Well, Pat, that's why I always say, make America great again. Let me read you my little quote that I was frantically searching for before. This pertains to our, when we were talking about the kitchen stuff. So this is from a book I found this year. It's by he's a psychologist named Mark Epstein, and he wrote this book called Thoughts Without a Thinker, and it's sort of a book about the intersection of psychology and Buddhism, and I really liked it, actually. I thought it combined the least bullshitty aspects of Buddhism and psychology into something that I found, I don't know, I changed how I thought about a lot of stuff. So this is a little anecdote he told. He says, in 1978, I traveled to a forest monastery in northeastern Thailand, Wat Ba Phong, on the Thai-Lao border. I was taken there by my meditation teacher, who was escorting a group of us to meet the monk under whom he had studied at that forest hermitage. This man, Achan Cha, described himself as, quote, a simple forest monk, and he ran a 100-acre forest monastery that was simple and old-fashioned, with one notable exception. Unlike most contemporary Buddhist monasteries in Thailand, where the practice of meditation, as the Buddha had taught, had all but died out, Achan Cha's demanded intensive meditation practice and a slow, deliberate, mindful attention to the mundane details of everyday life. He had developed a reputation as a meditation master of the first order. After breakfast on the first day, we were ushered into an audience with a Chan Cha, a severe-looking man with a kindly twinkle in his eyes. He sat patiently waiting for us to articulate the question that had brought us to him from such a distance. Finally, we made an attempt. "What are you really talking about? What do you mean by eradicating craving?" A Chan Cha looked down and smiled faintly. He picked up the glass of drinking water to his left. Holding it up to us, he spoke in the chirpy Lao dialect that was his native tongue. "You see this goblet? For me, this glass is already broken. I enjoy it. I drink out of it. It holds my water admirably, sometimes even reflecting the sun in beautiful patterns. If I should tap it, it has a lovely ring to it. But when I put this glass on a shelf and the wind knocks it over or my elbow brushes it off the table and it falls to the ground and shatters, I say, of course. When I understand that this glass is already broken, every moment with it is precious."
Oh, wow. That is super cool. That is super cool. And it seems to me that he's found this perfect place. He's not saying, you know, don't have a beautiful thing. It's like, recognize that. And again, that is absolutely Buddhism. All is transitory. All is change. And you know, the Buddhists, if I was going to sign on, you know, with a philosophy, I would probably go Buddhist, just because mathematically it's the most sound philosophical theory that I've ever encountered. I do try to stay close to it as much as I can. Have we chatted about this before?
We've touched on it a little bit. I think what we talked about was, like, we're both pretty interested in Buddhism. Like, I read a lot about Buddhism, and I have a sort of I have a pretty good meditation practice. Not the best it's ever been right now, but that's something that I found that sort of helps me collect myself and get my shit together.
Right. And I know that you actually practice some of the, you know, some of the, you pursue some of the practice of Buddhism, where for me it's primarily intellectual, where I know I almost think of it in terms of cognitive behavioral therapy or cognitive behavioral psychology, where, you know, the basic, the root tenet of Buddhism is, you know, there is suffering and that is a problem. So how do you take care of that? And you go, well, suffering comes from desiring something and then not attaining it. And so sort of the Western pursuit of not suffering is like, make sure you get all the things, right? You desire 100 cakes, therefore get 100 cakes. Do whatever you fucking can to get 100 cakes. And the Buddhists are like, look at that. And they're like, you know, actually, there's a way easier way to reduce suffering. How about you desire no cakes? And then immediately you have no suffering. And again, mathematically, it is unassailable in terms of a good philosophy that's intended to improve the quality of your life. And, you know, the truth is, the times in my life when I've attended to that and managed to achieve that, I have been very content and very happy. Because if you desire no cakes and you get one cake, you're like, ah, how lovely, you know, hashtag blessed. You know, and it's exactly what he's talking about there. It's like, you know, everything becomes precious if you're not constantly anticipating, you know, growing up and becoming a rock star forever, to like really mix that metaphor.
I bet these fucking Buddhist monks would enjoy working out with my personal trainer, Todd, too.